Don't Give Up Radio Show with Jackie Wayans. Inspiration through word and song for you.
So your world is torn apart and you're left with a broken heart and you feel that there's no real healing inside. Oh no, but this I know it's more than a feeling. Jesus said it in his word, you cannot feel it, just believe it. He'll make everything, he'll make it all right. He will make it all right.
Welcome to Don't Give Up Radio. I am your host, Jackie Wayans. And I don't know if you ever really listened to those lyrics as they play as we open the show, but, you know, this understanding that no matter what you've gone through in life, no matter how horrible, no matter what the despair, that God says that he has the power to make it all right. And a lot of times when we're going through that, we just don't believe it. Tonight's guest has experienced so much from the time she was a child, from rejection and abandonment and abduction, drugs, abuse, and yet she is here today to talk about God's love and his unmerited love at that, love that we don't even really truly deserve, but thankfully he's given to us. So I want you to tune your ears because we're going to go on a journey tonight, and I want you to hear very closely at what Tina Hobson's life has to offer and the wonderful book she's authored, Oh, How He Loves You and Me. And it's a blessing because many times we think only those who've had a silver spoon in their mouth can survive and thrive in this life. But if you have that special relationship with God, I'm telling you, he's no respecter of sins. What he's done for Tina, he can do for you. So, Tina, welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you here.
Jackie, thank you for this awesome opportunity. It's my honor and pleasure to be on your show tonight. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, we're going to get right to it because it's packed, and there's so much you have to say and share, and I want to make sure I give you as many seconds as I can give you. Now,
okay.
You know, when people listen to my show, they know I always go back to the past because, you know, our childhood, our past, it does shape us. It doesn't have to define who we become, but it does shape us in some ways, and that's particularly true for you, and we can, you know, just get a little glimpse of the early days of your life. Just share that with us.
Well, you know, I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and raised in Chicago by my aunt and uncle. My mom was an unwed mother, and in the early 50s, that was just not the popular thing to be. And I'm assuming that she felt that, you know, the best thing for me and for her was for me to live with my uncle and aunt in Chicago. And that's where I was raised from the age of 2 until I was 12. Very loving family. However, not being with my mother when I was old enough to realize that something was quite different. You know, my schoolmates, they had mothers and fathers, and all I had was my uncle and aunt. And even though they were loving and I loved them in return, there was always something missing. So in my head, I was always somebody else. I was taller, I was shorter, I was, you know, my hair was longer. I always wanted to be somebody else because I felt a sense of loss. You know, I was raised in the church. My aunt, she sent me to church every Sunday with a neighbor or another family member. And so I knew about God, I knew about his love, but however, I just didn't feel quite that I fit in, or that I live up to what God wanted me to be.
Well, let's roll that back a little bit because I want to dig in there. So here you are, your mom actually takes you to your aunt, who's quite older. She's already raised her own children, and you're being raised with her and your uncle. What was that experience like? Tell me about your aunt and that relationship.
Oh, my relationship with my aunt Faith was the best. It was the best. She was my best friend. She was my confidant. She was my breakfast. She was my lunch. She was my dinner. She was my protector. It was funny. She protected me against my uncle in so many situations because I was a spoiled brat. She spoiled me to death. And there was times that I knew that I took it over the limit, and when he wanted to chastise me or punish me, she just wouldn't allow it. She just wouldn't allow it. My aunt was a person who taught me. She was patient. She was very patient with me. And she taught me, she was the one who taught me how to be a woman. She taught me womanly or wifely duties that she performed for my uncle. She taught me how to wash clothes. She taught me how to iron. You know, she was the one who pierced my ears. She was my first beautician. She had the ironing comb on the stove and pressed my hair. She was just always there for me in spite of the fact that she was older. Her children were adults, and I was primarily raised with her grandchildren who would come to visit on the weekends and during summer vacation. So I wasn't a child that was alone. However, Jackie, I still felt lonely. I still felt lonely,
right,
because I felt that there was something still missing in my life.
Right. And that feeling was about to intensify because at the age of 12, you lost your aunt. She died. And you feel very strongly, you talk about in your book, that it just opened the door for years of turmoil in your life. So let's go back to the, you know, from you even finding out about her death and how things were handled after that. How were you treated? Where did you go from there?
You know, Jackie, even 50 years later, I'm 62 years old, and she died when I was 12. I still have intense feelings. There's times when I've felt that I've gone through all of the stages of grief, and I'm at that acceptance point when I'm really, really not. Like I said, I was 12 when she passed away, and that was an experience that was strange to me. I hadn't experienced death before, and the way it happened, it was like God was speaking to me through that particular experience. She was in the hospital. I was already angry because I couldn't go to see her because during those times, children weren't allowed in the hospital, so I didn't know what was wrong with her. I couldn't go see her. I couldn't talk to her. That was my best friend. That was my best friend. Why can't I talk to her? So it was this particular night in February, just before her birthday, the phone rang in the middle of the night, and I automatically knew that something was wrong. I knew it. In my heart, I knew it. When I walked out of my bedroom door, which I slept with her most of the time, and when I walked out and opened the bedroom door, there was this eerie type of a creaking sound. And I knew something just wasn't right. I gave the phone, I answered the phone, I gave the phone to my uncle, and he broke the news to me that she was gone. Okay, my heart is just totally done now. How can God do this to me? How could she do this to me? How could she leave me knowing that I felt that she was the only person I had? My life was just, it was done. You know, I'm sitting around and family is coming in and I'm watching them laughing and talking and I'm like, you know, kids were seen and not heard. And I'm saying to myself, what in the heck is so funny? How can anybody be happy? I just lost my best friend. And through all of this disconnectedness, not being connected with anybody spiritually now, in no sense of the word, I'm what do I do? What do I do? I can't talk to anybody about this. My uncle, okay, he pretty soon went right back to work. I'm angry with him. He's leaving me. I was left alone. What do I do? I didn't know what to do with all those feelings, so I started acting out. It was a subconscious, unconscious thing, but it was real. I started smoking cigarettes. I started, you know, acting out with boys. I was hanging out with the so-called, what they called in the 50s, the fast girls. The girls who just, you know, did anything that they wanted to. And it got to the point, Jackie, where my uncle, he couldn't take it anymore. I was unruly. I was, you know, leaving out the house in the middle of the night, you know, skimming the steps, getting out, going out, coming back in all times of night. He caught me one night, and he said that was it. That was it. He loved me, but he just couldn't handle a teenage girl. I'm just turning 13.
Right.
He didn't know what to do with me. So he called my mom into the picture. And my mom, we had a relationship. She would visit me holidays, birthdays, special occasions. But at the end of the day, she was gone again. She and my grandmother and my brother, who she had like a year, year and a half later, they were back in Ohio. They left me there with my aunt. No understanding of why am I in Chicago? Why is my brother staying with her? Still a mystery.
Right.
Still a mystery. So I just, well, I told God, I made a conscious decision and a verbal decision. I'm going to run my own life. I'm 13 years old. I don't know nothing about running my life, but I felt nobody else cared. So I'm going to do what I want to do. And the journey just went downhill from now. When you talked about a journey, this is exactly what my life was.
Wow. You know, I'm listening because here your uncle calls your mom to come and get you. You don't really have a relationship with her. She's taking you. And for a moment there, you thought you were going to maybe have an opportunity to live with her, but instead she drops you off at your grandmother's. And so your behavior continues to escalate. You continue to do the same things there that you were doing before. And things changed one night when you couldn't get back into your grandmother's house, and a wonderful lady by the name of Miss Brown called your mom to ask what to do with you, and your mom said, keep her. And she did. She went through the protocols of taking you in as a foster child. At that point, did your behavior change? Did you still have the mentality that you were going to stay in control of your own life?
Jackie, my feelings were mixed. They were really mixed, and my behaviors were mixed. I did have more of a sense of being wanted, you know, because when my mother brought me from Chicago, my hopes were built up because I think, okay, I'm finally going to live with my mom. I'm going to have a relationship with her. But no, she dropped me off at my grandmama's house. And so I'm angry. I am so angry now. And then I'm watching my grandmother go through the early signs of Alzheimer's, of dementia, which nobody really knew anything about. And I was talking about different changes in her behavior, but I was told to be quiet because I didn't know what I was talking about. So I'm coming home from this game one night. I couldn't get in the house. Grandma wouldn't open the door. Miss Brown took me in. She called my mom. My mom said, keep her. And that's exactly what she did. She made it legal, but I was still a lonely, angry, frustrated, just disappointed little girl. So, yes, in a sense, I was still acting out. I was acting out still with, you know, the guys. I was still smoking. I had started to drink now. I became pregnant at the age of 15. Somehow I got this sense of
righteousness. Hold on. You're giving me too much. I can't take it. So listen, we are going to come back because clearly, you know, you were exposed to God and church early on, but at this point, as you already said, you know, you start to feel out of place, uncomfortable, like it was a place that you didn't fit. And, you know, many people can relate to that. And as we go to this next song, I want you to think about the fact that there are times in your life that you feel like everything is going wrong, that you're going to just crumble and fall apart. But I want you to know that God didn't create you to fall apart, and that there's a strength in you that you just don't know yet. And when we come back, we'll find out more about Tina's strength.
Ooh, yeah. Lost touch with my soul. I had nowhere to turn. I had nowhere to go. Lost sight of my dream. Me. I thought I'd never make it through. I had no hope to hold on to. I thought I would break. didn't know my own strength, and I crashed down and I tumbled, but I did not crumble. I got through all the pain. I didn't know my own strength, survived my darkest hour. My faith kept me alive. I picked myself back up, hold my head up high. I was not built to break. I didn't know my own strength. Oh, found hope in my heart. I found the light to light my way out of the dark. Found all that I
Jackie Wayans. Inspiration through word and song for you.
And indeed, we are being inspired tonight by Tina Hobson's story, the author of Oh, How He Loves Me. And, you know, right before we went to that song, which so graciously talks about a person who doesn't really know yet the strength that's in them, and you can't know until you actually go through some bits and some trials. So right before we ended, you said that at 15, you wound up becoming pregnant. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, 15, I became pregnant because I'm still acting out because I've still got all of these untreated feelings and emotions, and I don't know what to do with them, so I'm acting out sexually. And I got pregnant. I got married when I was 16. I was allowed to do that because my thought was I convinced Ms. Brown, my foster mother, that, you know, this was the right thing to do. This was a godly thing to do. But deep down inside in my head, I'm thinking, okay, I don't want anybody to control me. I thought marriage was supposed to have been, you know, this white picket fence, and I could do what I want to do, be who I wanted to be. But I'm forgetting. I'm not realizing I'm already in the throes of addiction. I'm drinking. I'm smoking weed. So I was already out of control. I'm trying to bring control to an out of control situation, and getting married was something that, you know, I joke and say if I had been my first husband, I wouldn't have married me because I was out of control. The marriage didn't work. Eventually, you know, I left him at the age of 18. We stayed together for a while. I had two children by then. And I just couldn't take it anymore. I just couldn't. It was like I was bursting at the seams. My whole inside was bursting. I had to get out. I just had to get out. So I left my children. I left my husband. And, again, still the journey continued. Right at this point, I'm still on that green sliding board. Not going too fast, but I'm going down. I'm going down.
Right, right. Because you left because, you know, you wanted this sense of control, that you would have control over yourself, and you didn't want anyone, any parent or foster parent or uncle or aunt or husband telling you what to do. And so you, you know, got this control. You left everything. You left your kids. You left your husband. And, you know, some people look at starting over, turning over a new leaf, but your life did drastically change, but in what direction?
It kept going down. It kept going down no matter, you know, my realization of there was a God. I'm angry with him. I'm still very, very angry with God at this time. I was from time to time, I was going to church because Ms. Brown, she would, you know, she, that was part of her routine, you know, was to go to church every Sunday. I would go, but my spirit and my soul wasn't in it. It was not in it at all. I miss my aunt so desperately bad that on top of that, still not being certain of who I was, you know, to this day, I still don't know who my biological father is. I don't know the true story of me going to live with my aunt in Chicago. It's so many still question marks that were in my head that, like I said, I felt like I was about to explode. I didn't know, like Whitney said, I didn't know my own strength. I didn't know because it was so many other things going on inside of me. I couldn't think clearly. I couldn't think clearly. Plus, I'm still a young girl. I'm still a young, very immature, unsatisfied, desperate little girl looking for a place to really belong, not knowing that I had to find that I had to fill that hole within me through me and through God. I couldn't find it on the outside. It wasn't there. Nobody could do that for me but God.
And you did what most people do in that scenario is the drinking, the smoking weed, and you ended up, in order to support those habits, once you were in control of yourself, making decisions that were not healthy, such as prostituting, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And that was still, I'm on that sliding board. I'm going down. It's starting to go faster now, and I'm still smoking weed. I'm still drinking. By now, I'm using cocaine. I'm using pills. I'm using sex. I'm using sex not only just for my own pleasure, trying to fill that void in my spirit, but I'm now having to use it to support myself because, you know, my mom and my dad have my children. There's no income coming in. I was employable, but I couldn't keep a job because I was just all over the place. I couldn't think straight. So I'm not working on a regular basis. So the easy thing I could think to do was I was introduced to prostitution, and I did it. But even that didn't satisfy me. You know, going through the motions, just being with man after man after man, getting raped. While I'm out on the streets, you know, and I'm thinking I can't report it because I'm out there giving myself away, not knowing that rape is rape. And when I say no, it meant no. So here comes some more misery. Here comes more guilt, more shame, more destitution. It was just hard. And then it got to the point where it got so hard that I started contemplating and actually acting it out in attempting to commit suicide.
Wow. Wow. There's so much I want to ask you with everything that you said. The suicidal tendencies, how early did that really start with you? You know, clearly with your aunt passing and everything happening in your life, you were dealing with the depression, but had no one in the world to tell you that or help you deal with that. So when did the suicidal tendencies begin with you?
It was at a very early age. The first false attempt, and even with it being a false attempt, I know I was reaching out for attention. I wanted somebody to say they saw me, they felt me, they heard me, that they knew I was there. Me and my husband had got into a heated argument, something that I had done because I'm still acting out even in our marriage. And so to take the focus off of my behavior, but I'm still looking for attention, I pretended that I had took this bottle of pills. I didn't. But it got me some temporary attention, which didn't last. You know, he took me to my mom. She, you know, called the paramedics or the emergency room, and they told her what to do. She was a nurse also, so she pretty much knew what to do, not to let me go to sleep or whatever. But it was short-lived. It wasn't
But
enough.
You actually had
enough.
A number of real incidents where you tried pills, where you tried, you know, turning on the gas, and it's like God blocked it every single time and wouldn't allow it to occur. And those are times where you don't really understand why it's happening, why God is intervening now. You're like, all the other times you could intervene now is when you, but it's because he has a purpose and a plan, and he's allowing the time to happen for it to unfurl. Going back to what you were saying about, you know, being on the streets and even being taken advantage of, even though you were prostituting, but you were even abducted at one point, correct?
Yes. Oh, I can remember so clearly. It was a bright, sunshiny Sunday afternoon. Me and the guy I had been dating, we had gotten into an argument. So I needed to clear my head. So I'm taking a walk in the middle of Cleveland, broad daylight, and I noticed this car pass by me, but then they backed up. They backed up. So I'm looking. Maybe it's somebody I know. So I'm looking in the car to see who it was, and before I could turn back around, and you know, when I didn't recognize anybody, these guys jumped out of the car with guns pulled. So what had happened while they were talking and bragging and talking about what they were going to do, in fact, they threatened me to the point where they said that if I didn't comply with what they wanted, which was for them to put me out on the street to prostitute for them, that they would fit me with a pair of cement boots. It got real dramatic. It got real dramatic, and I became totally afraid, but not afraid to the point where the adrenaline of the fear didn't work in my favor this time, because they turned a corner on this one street. They were going back in the direction of where I lived, and God, this was one of those old cars where the back window was one of those little small windows, and I was telling them I couldn't breathe. I needed some air, and as they were rolling down the window, I was, excuse me, Jackie, I was actually able to jump head first out of this car. And I guess it scared them. And when I jumped, these little boys came to my rescue. Miss, I know you. You live across around the corner. I had them run to get my get the people that I was living with. I ran into this little lady's house, and my friends came and got me. And that they were my heroes. They were my heroes. And, you know, as much as attention that I wanted, I did not want that type of attention. It was scary. It was very, very scary.
No, I was saying, as you're talking, I'm just seeing almost like a movie play out in my head, because you have all these, you know, dramatic moments where you can really see and feel them. I'm sure that our listeners are connecting with you right now. And, you know, I want to ask, just, you know, the human side of me wants to find out, after that experience of almost being abducted and being threatened, sunk in the bottom of the river, you know, with cement boots, did that jolt you? Was that a turning point for you to change things in the direction of your life?
Ironically, no, because like you said, I'm still suffering from this undiagnosed, untreated depression. All of these feelings, now it's more and more feelings. I can't even kill myself right. You know, I still don't have the love that I want, that I think that I should have. You know, I'm still going from man to man, person to person, you know, trying to fill that hole in my soul and it's just not happening. And I'm still missing my aunt tremendously. I'm still missing her because she was always the one that was there. Whenever I had a boo-boo, she was there to kiss it and make me feel and make me better. Now I don't have anybody. I don't have anybody. So I'm still searching. I'm still searching.
And
I can't even kill myself now.
I that is a line, right? That's tweetable. I can't even kill myself, right? But that just shows you where your mindset was, that so beaten down, so downtrodden that you're thinking, oh my goodness, I can't even kill myself correctly, you know. Meanwhile, it was God's hand of protection on you, which you'll find out later. But one of the things that in terms of you searching and searching for this hole that you want to have filled is that you decided to get remarried again. Tell us about the gentleman. What was his characteristics? You know, what did you know for sure as you were going into this marriage?
At this point, I'm not caring. I don't even care. I'm almost like walking into situations with my eyes wide open. This man was a career criminal. He was a heroin addict. He was not about to try to be employable. He just did what he did to get his next fix. Heroin was his first love, and I knew that. Even though I knew that, I said, well, maybe I can still have a place in this man's life. He would say some of the right things sometimes, but he was very verbally abusive. The verbal abuse turned into the physical abuse, to times where we got into where he fought me so bad or beat me so bad that I could look in the mirror and not even recognize the person that was looking back at me. But I'm still trying to find something, somebody. So my thought was, okay, heroin is his first love. If you can't beat him, join him. I'm already doing everything else. What the heck? What the heck?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got married and it was a farce. It was a farce. He was late for the wedding. I made my own wedding dress, which was jet black silk. If that wasn't a message to everybody, I don't know what was. You know, our honeymoon, our wedding night was getting high. We shot dope all night. That was what our life was all about. Even though by this time, because I'm living in Indianapolis, I had a good job, you know. I was working at the Army base, so I had a good job. But my addiction was still there. I was still drinking. I was still smoking weed. I was still shooting dope. I was still doing all the wrong things.
Hold on a minute, though, because what I want to find out is because usually God plants some little light, some person, some passing figure to tell us something. So I'm wondering if there was anyone around you who observed your hurt that told you, you know, you can do better. Was there anything like that in your world?
When I was in Indianapolis, I did have, I worked at this one liquor store, and the owner, he was watching me. He was watching me. He saw the bruises. He saw the marks from me shooting dope and everything, and he did come to me, even though he had some motives too, because I guess he's looking at me as a vulnerable, easy person to get over. But he did tell me this one day that I could do better, that I could be better, that my life could change. I didn't believe it because I'm looking at the fact that he's still, you know, trying to make a pass. So I'm looking at him like I'm looking at every other man. I'm looking at either how to get you off of me or how I can take advantage of you. Since you're trying to take advantage of me, I'm going to beat you to it. Then later.
But he did plant a seed, though. He planted a seed in you, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you
Jackie,
got the courage,
you know,
actually. Yeah, go ahead.
He made me think. He made me think briefly. You know, that maybe I could do something better. Maybe I could be something better. And it was after that I did get the real good job on the Army base. And financially,
you had the courage to leave the relationship that you were in, right? You did leave that relationship,
eventually,
right?
Eventually, it had to be in a situation where he was actually in jail, and he was still verbally abusing me. But when I thought that he wasn't going to get out, like, right away, I did call my mom and my dad from here in Cleveland, and they came and got me before he was released from prison.
Okay,
so
well, the journey continues. Yes, the journey continues, and we are going to hear more when we get back. Clearly, you are an individual that was wounded and needed healing for your soul, and we know that now there is a God that is perfectly capable of healing any wound that you may have. So when we turn to
for my soul. And I'm tired of crying all night just for my soul. Lord, I need thee, oh, I need thee to take away this pain and misery. Cause God, I just can't do this by myself. I need a help, Lord. Gave my body and my soul away. So now I come to you just to be whole. Heal my soul, Lord.
I need a healing for my soul.
Come on and heal me. Would you please be about me, Lord?
I need you, I need you, I need you,
I need you. I need you, I need you, I need you.
Don't Give Up Radio Show with Jackie Wayans. Inspiration through word and song for you.
I need a healing for my soul if you are listening tonight, and that is you. I would ask you to start with Romans 10 and 9, which says, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. And at that moment, he sends his spirit to abide with you and to communicate with you. You become a part of his family. You become a child of God, not just a creation, but a child. And in this relationship, the healing communication can begin, and that's where everything starts. So it doesn't matter how badly you've been wounded. Yes, it matters because it hurts. It matters because you've been through it. But it doesn't matter in terms of keeping God from loving you. It doesn't matter in terms of allowing his hand to come into your life and begin to change and turn everything around. So we are here with Tina Hobson, and she is sharing with us her life's journey, which has had very few glimpses of pleasure outside of her aunt who passed away when she was 12 years old. And here she is. She's gone through drugs and prostitution and, you know, getting married more than once and abusive relationships and finding out that nothing is filling this hole inside of her. And, you know, Tina, I have to ask you, because there is that thing inside of us where we know we want to do better, but we're clueless as to how to even begin. And I remember reading that in your book. Tell us about that feeling, and how did you begin to work your way back?
You know, Jackie, I describe and define that feeling as a feeling of being unnecessary. And that's what it all boiled down to. Why am I here? What am I here for? God, why did you even allow me to be born? You know, even with those questions, I still had not gotten to that point where I was asking for help, where I was even praying anymore. I hadn't prayed since I was 12 years old. I was angry. But having been introduced to even more drugs, that if I had a worse enemy, I wouldn't wish crack cocaine on them. And I became a crack cocaine user. And through that, after coming back home, after my mom and dad bringing me back home, being back with my mom, being with my children again, being with other family members, there was still that void. There was still that void. Nothing still was making me happy. Today I know why, because I wasn't allowing the one person who could make me happier than anybody that I needed an intimate relationship with, and that was God. I wasn't allowing that to happen. However, he was still not taking his hand off of me. He still wanted me to live to show, for him to get the glory for everything that he had done for me in spite of me.
You know, one of the things you talk about in the book is the feeling of shame and embarrassment and condemnation. They got to a point, crack cocaine is different than other drugs in how it really affects you and rips your life apart. I mean, drugs are bad, period. But you really describe crack cocaine as being the bottom of the barrel. Talk about what it did to your life and how bad it made things.
Of all the drugs that I used, especially when I stopped using heroin, I actually felt a sense of pride that I was able to kick that habit. But I replaced it with the crack cocaine, which took me straight to the depths of hell. The stealing just, it manifested. I didn't care who I got high with, how I got high. You know, even drug dealers was telling me, you know, you're a nice lady. Why are you doing this? You know, because I'm getting older now. I'm in my 30s. So I'm getting older. I should know better. I don't know how to know better because I'm still on this road of destruction, self-destruction. Even the people that I was getting high with, I knew they were talking about me. I knew they were using me. But I still needed something. I'm still looking for something to fill that hole. neighbors and my mom, they knew what was going on. My children knew what was going on. I'm losing what, if I had any self-respect left, that was gone now. My children aren't happy even with me being back home now because they're embarrassed because their friends know. I'm feeling a sense of embarrassment, but now with crack cocaine, it would have been such a psychological drug, having such a psychological hold on me. It wasn't physical. It was psychological. All my focus, everything was, how am I going to get that next rock? How am I going to get it? Where am I going to get it? Still that feeling of loneliness. Who am I going to use it with? And it took me to the throes of hell. That I was right at that bottom of that grease light, of that grease sliding board now.
And your mom actually came to a point where she had to issue an ultimatum to you. What was that, and what did you do?
It was, she came to the point, I guess the embarrassment got too much for her, and now, you know, where I was holding jobs and was making money, or either I was doing whatever illegal thing I need to do to make money to be able to help, you know, provide her with some money. When that stopped, everything stopped. We lived in this small town, Chagrin Falls. She said, this city, Chagrin Falls is too small for both of us. You've got to go. You've got to go. So I lived in a hotel for a while. I slept in my car for a while. I finally was able to, I can't say I pulled myself together. I started looking for work, and this gentleman named Bart Ainsley, he was my angel. He was my angel. He gave me a job, even looking like the mess that I was in, and he allowed me to work in his store, and eventually when he knew that I was homeless, he allowed me to live in the back of the store where I was working at, and I wasn't even working there. I was going through the motions. It was a way for me to not have to go out and prostitute myself but still get money because I was writing money orders and stealing money out of his cash register on a daily basis.
Huh. So now this is definitely the point where we get to see exactly how God is intervening and his unmerited everlasting love, because you really had to hit rock bottom. It's like there was no reason for this man to hire you. You said you looked bad, you smelled bad. I mean, you have a great personality that was coming through, but really there was no reason for him to hire you, yet he did. And he kept asking you if you mm-hmm. needed help. And at first you were denying it, but then after a breaking point happened. So talk to us about it.
Yes, this man hired me. And, you know, we had talked about my personality. That was God shining through me, Jackie. It couldn't have been anything else, because everything else, the way I looked, the way I smelled, it had to supersede my personality. It was God shining through, getting ready to really do his thing. But Bart hired me, and like you said, he kept asking me, did I have a problem? And initially I would say no. This man would literally get on his knees every evening at the end of the day and pray for me. He would ask me to pray with him. I would pray. I would talk to myself, wishing that he would hurry up and stop praying so he could leave so I could steal the money out of the cash register. He knew what I was doing, but he prayed for me every single day. Mm-hmm. He was the perfect example of an unconditional friend. He loved me in spite of me. He wasn't making any passes. He wasn't trying to get anything from me. He was trying to give mm-hmm. everything to me. He was trying to give me God back. He was trying to give me my life back. And eventually mm-hmm. that is exactly what happened. I admitted that I had a problem. I don't know where that came from. You know, I'm sitting in the back of this store one night. I'm sleeping on the cot, and my first prayer in 30 years was, almost 25 years, was, God, help me. I didn't know anything else to say. I didn't know. I had gotten that desperate that all I could say is, help me. I've, I talked about that feeling of being unnecessary. I'm like, God, either kill me or cure me. One or the other. Please help me one way or the other. And he did. Bart, he had used Bart to bring me to that realization that enough was enough. I went, Bart got me connected with a treatment program. I got there, they took one look at me, and I guess I was such an extreme case, they sent me straight to an emergency room, which turned out to be a psychiatric emergency room. I didn't know what treatment was all about, but I'm thinking, you know, after they did the assessment and everything, that they were going to send me to a treatment program. Jackie, they sent me straight to a mental institution. And today I can admit I was crazy. I was crazy because wow. Who else would do the things that they had done to themselves? Because depression is a mental illness, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It took me to that place where I didn't have any place else to go. I couldn't go any farther down. Lost my car, lost my home, lost all respect for myself. My children lost respect. Mom don't want to see me no more. Okay, I didn't have anything else. I didn't. And that's where God needed me to be. He needed to get me in the position where I was childlike again, where I was humble, where he could mend me, shape me, mold me into the person that he had originally meant for me to be. And that's exactly what happened to me in that mental institution.
Yeah, you say actually in the book that the mental institution saved your life. How so?
It was where I came to a realization that it was only God. For once in such a long time, Jackie, I had a real bed to sleep in. I had three hot meals to eat. Even though these other residents in this place, they had mental issues. I didn't, at that time, I didn't think I had one, but I knew they did. But these people loved me unconditionally. They wanted to be my friend. They didn't ask for anything in return. They talked to me. They laughed with me. We played games together. And they were unconditional friends. Bart still was in my corner. He would come to see me. But I'm still complaining. He put me in a position where I had to be quiet. I had to go to the dictionary and find the definition of the word gratitude. And it was right then and there that God worked a miracle. He worked a miracle in me, Jackie. I'm in my room in this mental institution, and I got this feeling of grandiosity. I wanted to pray. I really wanted to pray, but I wanted to pray a grandiose prayer. God said, uh-uh. My mouth opened, and the words that came out were my childhood prayer. Lord, I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. That was nobody but God. I was talking, but I was not saying those words. It was him teaching me a lesson and showing me what he was going to do with me. And he's been doing it. He's been doing it since November the 1st, 1989. He has worked. He's always worked the miracles in me. But it's been since then that I've actually been able to recognize the blessings and the lessons and the love that he has had for me all this time, how he's cradled me and rocked me and loved me and protected me and carried me through all of those bad times, through the nasty part of the journey up through my deliverance.
In fact, you say that, you know, from that prayer forward, you were completely delivered. You never were able to drink or do drugs again from that moment. And you've been clean for the past 20 years or is it 30?
It's going on 26 years, November the 1st this year.
Absolutely awesome. Our time has flown this evening, but there's one thing that I want people to hear and leave them with, because if that isn't miraculous enough that he could take someone who was in all that addiction and all that pain and completely deliver them, you have a wonderful phrase in the book. We know TGIF as Thank God It's Friday, but you changed it to Thank God I'm Forgiven. Tell us about what you're thanking him about today and all the things that he's done in your life, because, you know, someone who, you know, had a baby at 15 clearly didn't even graduate high school. So what has God done in your life over the past 20 years?
Wow. Along with that phrase, I use another one. It's never too late to be great as long as you believe in him. Thank God I'm forgiven. He allowed me to go back to school where I didn't have a high school diploma. I have a bachelor's in social work. I'm a licensed social worker. I went from addict to author. Who would have thought it, that I'm actually writing, working on a third book with the help of other authors. But that one standalone book, my pride and my joy, oh, how he loves me, reflections of God's love for me and for you. That's all about him. You know, family relationships have mended. My daughter and I hadn't spoken for years. We have a very loving and understanding relationship today. I have a relationship with my two-year-old great-granddaughter. My children, you know, it feels kind of strange, so we're working our way through this relationship, but it's a relationship. It's a distant, estranged relationship anymore. My mom, I'm still working on her. We still work. God's still working on her. She can still be a piece of work. But no matter what, I love her today. I love her today in spite of her. I'm employable. You know, I've been managers of several drug and alcohol treatment programs and mental health programs. God has done a work with me. I go to church on a regular basis. Not just here and there, and I don't need nobody to take me. I take myself. He's just done a work. He's done a work. I have been forgiven. I have been forgiven, and all of this and so much more is evidence of that.
Awesome. You really are a testimony of what this show is all about. Don't give up, because you had every reason to throw in the towel and call it a day. But God kept his hand on your life, and he kept waiting. He kept waiting for that moment and opportunity for you to see the winner that was in you all along. Because in the beginning of the show, you know, we played the song, I Didn't Know My Own Strength, but he knew. I didn't know my own strength, but he knew what it was. And he knew that there was a winner in you, and he brought you to a place where you could say, yes, Lord. And sometimes, you know, not sometimes, all the time. That's what all of us need to do. It's not just your story. It's all of us. We need to get to that place of yielding and surrender. And so I just want to thank you so much for sharing with us this evening.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you for continue this process of allowing me to cleanse my spirit, because every time I tell my story, I get a little bit better. I get a little bit better.
Absolutely awesome. To those of you who are listening, I want you to continue to be your own best hero, because the greatest hero of all said that you are worth it when he gave his life for you. You are a winner. There is a winner in you. And despite what you've gone through, hold on to that truth. Until next week.
My friends still had demands on me.